Like a chrysalis, we're emerging from the economy of the Industrial Revolution. An economy confined to and limited by the Earth's physical resources into the economy in mind, in which there are no bounds on human imagination, and the freedom to create is the most precious natural resource.
Welcome to the Soul of Enterprise, Business and the Knowledge Economy, sponsored by Sage, transforming the way people think and work, enabling their organizations to thrive. I'm Ron Baker, along with my good friend and VeriSage Institute colleague, Ed Kless. On today's show, folks, we're going to be talking about private equity and accounting with Michael Bright from Eisner Amper. Ed, how's it going?
Great, Ron. Looking forward to the conversation today.
Yeah, me too. And our social media guy is out, Greg Kite on PTO. So we're on our own.
Tirico, not Tirico. Kite. You got the wrong Greg.
Sorry, man. Sorry, good group. I'm never going to live that down. All right. Well, let me read Michael in here. He's got a really long biography, and I can't do it justice, but I'll just say Michael Bright is chairman and CEO of Eisner Amper, LLP, the attest firm, and a partner at Eisner Advisory Group, LLC. He's got 35 years plus public accounting experience and has held leadership positions throughout his career at Eisner, including vice chair, strategic relationships, regional managing partner, partner in charge of the New York office, and audit and assurance leader. Prior to joining Eisner, Michael was a partner at a Big Four accounting firm. Michael Bright, welcome to the Soul of Enterprise.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Ron.
What Big Four were you at?
I was at, well, I started my career at Ernst & Whinney, now Ernst & Young.
That's it. That's how you carbon date a CPA, Ernst & Whinney. I know exactly when you started. I was at Pete Marrick Mitchell, so Big Eight like you. Well, Michael, I'm going to dive right in. I'm not even going to go to your bio. I want to jump right into private equity because it's a huge topic. Maybe Ed can explore your bio a little bit and how you got to where you are, but we know accounting firms tend to be somewhat recession-proof. They throw off strong cash flows. They're relationship-based. They have year-round revenue, relatively little risk. What makes them so attractive to private equity? Is it those things, or is it more than that? And vice versa, what makes private equity attractive to accounting firms such as yours?
So I think that, for years, we wondered why private equity didn't get into accounting firms, and they were a little worried about getting their hands around some independence concerns, which we all know are the sacrosanct of every accounting firm. But once they got their hands around that, and that's happened over the last few years, they realized, as you said, Ron, there's an annuity base, especially in the audit and tax group. They provide steady cash flow. It is relatively risk-free, and I say relatively risk-free, depending on what areas you're in. But and they seem to be growing every year. I mean, we at Eisner Amper, we're growing every year, new clients, new services. And so when private equity looked at us, they said, wow, you guys are firmly in the mid-market. You have great relationships. And they did their diligence, and they spoke to our clients as well. And when you have those strong, deep relationships, that also goes a long way.
Awesome. Well, why don't you explain how your firm structured the deal with the private equity firm? And I know you split off assurance from tax and advisory. Can you kind of walk through that as best you can and explain it?
Of course. So any private equity firm is corporate owned, so they cannot technically sign off on an audit, review, or compilation opinion, which creates what they call, and very, very common, alternative practice structure, whereby the accountants, again, who do the audit opinions, reviews, and compilations are separated out. So it's just those partners, typically in a limited liability partnership. And they operate through an administrative services agreement with, again, the old accounting firm that now handles tax, advisory, and consulting. So again, we go to market as Eisner Amper, even though we have a separate executive committee at Eisner Amper LLP that I chair and I'm the CEO. But we speak with our colleagues every day at Eisner Advisory Group LLC, going to market where Eisner Amper, our proposals go out at Eisner Amper. Yes, we'll have separate bills from audit that say Eisner Amper LLP, and the tax bill will say Eisner Advisory Group LLC. Our engagement letters are on different letterhead. But other than that, we go to market as Eisner Amper, and we're together through this alternative practice structure and an administrative services agreement.
Awesome. And when did you do this, Michael?
So we did this July 31, 21. We met Tower Brook exactly a year before, at July 31, 2020. We got to know them very well. And one of the keys for us was one of the advisors to Tower Brook was the former chairman of Deloitte International. His name was John Connolly. John Connolly is currently chairman of Eisner Advisory Group. Also with Tower Brook was a fellow by the name of David Holtz. David Holtz was the CFO and then became the COO of Ernst & Young. So because John Connolly was there and David Holtz was there, it gave us a tremendous amount of comfort that these guys really knew what they were doing, because they knew the professional services environment. They knew the ebbs and flows. They knew the independence. They knew the investment complex rules, not to get too technical, but they really knew what they were doing. And it took us a year to go through the transaction and what we wanted to accomplish and to make sure our interests were aligned. And again, our 3-year anniversary is coming up this July.
Wow. And what did you guys see in it? What was in it for you?
So I guess I put together an acronym, Ron, and I could go over it with you, and I call it STAR. And STAR stands for Succession Technology. A is for access, and A is access not only to capital, know-how, connections, and the R is for recruiting. So first of all, succession. We really didn't have any issue with succession. We had a great board. We had a lot of people in place. Charlie Weinstein, the longstanding CEO. We had a succession committee for him as well. But we had a lot of strong candidates to replace Charlie. But typically, why people go through private equity is succession. That really wasn't a main driver for us. Technology was a big driver because we were able then to obviously use the power of the resources of Tower Brook to really drive technology into our practice groups into a much, much greater way. Our technology budget exploded from $18 million to over $35 million in just a few years. So that was a very, very big deal in regard to really moving forward with technology. And then I said capital. Well, it's the access to capital and access to their know-how. So one of our advisors, the former head of digital enterprise over at KPMG. So he also now converses with us. He converses with our CIO to help us get to a better place. So having that access to people like John Connolly and David Holtz and others was enormous. And then lastly, recruiting. We just think we'll be in a much, much better spot and have a much better story to tell. You know, when I went into public accounting, Ron, as you did a long, long time ago, we said, all right, we put our heads down and we said, all right, we'll work our tails off for 12, 13, 14 years. We'll become a partner. And then they'll say, congratulations, work here another 25, 30 years, and then we'll pay your pension. And now when you go to young people nowadays and give them that, landscape, they look at you cross-eyed. They go, really? You want me to dedicate the next 35 to 40 years of my life? That just doesn't happen anymore, because we see people who are 30 years old and they've already had 3 careers and 7 different jobs already. So they do like the fact that, hey, there could be a monetization event every 5 to 7 years. It's extraordinarily appealing to them. So our recruiting just spots in the number of people that have come back and our goals. We've met every one of our recruiting goals because we're telling a different story.
You know, somebody really wise, Michael, that we both know said private equity comes in and they say it'll be business as usual. He says, but what they don't say is you have a new partner to answer to. What's that been like?
You do. So, you know, we do now have a board and Charlie reports to the board. So I speak to Charlie all the time. But as it relates to my position, because, again, we're separate from Tower Brook, you know, I only report to the executive committee that we formed a few years ago. So I might have the best job in the world, Ron, because at the end of the day, I really don't report to the board. But Charlie and I have an understanding, and I just can't go out and spend $10 million on the things that I want to do. But no, Charlie reports to the board, quarterly board meetings, et cetera, et cetera.
And you're coming up on your 3 years in July. How would you grade it so far? What's been the advantages of it?
I think it's been an incredible ride. We've now done 20 transactions already. So we had incredible first mover advantage, wow. You know, following us with Citrin Cooperman, Sherry Beckert, and most recently, Baker Tilly, and just this morning, Grant Thornton. So the first mover advantage, it was a huge, huge advantage. And going through the integration and telling our story and seeing colleagues come together in a collegial environment has been extraordinarily rewarding for me and very gratifying.
And Michael, looking out, I mean, most private equity firms have a horizon of between 3 and 7 years, 4 and 7 years, usually no more than 10. What happens at the end of that? What's the exit strategy for Tower Brook?
So I wish I could tell you very specifically, because I get that question maybe 10 times a day. Who will you be sold to? And I would say, you know, I have no clue. It could be another private equity firm. Could be a sovereign wealth fund. Could be an insurance company. It could be a larger accounting firm. But the guys at Tower Brook are very, very bright. They know what they're doing. And there, I got to tell you, beyond optimistic in regard to what we're doing, where we're going, and where we're heading down the road. So I do believe a monetization event will clearly happen in a couple of years.
And so they're not really pressuring you for the short-term payoff versus what you need to do long-term to keep those relationships and innovation?
No, not at all. I mean, obviously, they have a lot in regard to direction, managing. You know, we manage the business, but they're incredible sounding boards and give us a lot of great direction.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I know Ed's probably going to ask you some about that technology budget that exploded. But Michael, this is flying by. And unfortunately, we're up against our first break. And folks, we'd like to remind you, if you want to contact me or Ed, send us an email to asktsoe@verisage.com. Do check out our Patreon channel, where you can get access to our bonus content. And you can find that at patreon.com/TSOE, and that channel is now sponsored by 90 Minds. It's a matter of mind. Check out their work at 90minds.com. And now a word from our sponsors.
Follow Voice America at facebook.com/Voice America for juicy updates from your favorite radio shows and podcasts.
Have you ever read a book that changed your life? I sure have. Have you ever listened to an advertisement for a book so many times that you question the existence of God? Me too. Hello, I'm Greg Kite. I recorded the advertisement for Ron and Ed's book, The Soul of Enterprise, Dialogues on Blah 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 Whatever, and 4 years later, we're all tired of it, especially me. But thankfully, there's a solution. For just $10 a month, you never have to hear my voice again. For a commercial-free version of The Soul of Enterprise, go to patreon.com/TSOE and subscribe now.
Sage provides accountants with compliance, reporting, and analytic solutions to do more for their clients. These solutions include education programs such as the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Service Program. This program delivers the tools to create, package, price, market, and deliver additional services to clients, increasing your profitability and delivering more value to your clients. Let Sage help you grow your business by visiting sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned into The Soul of Enterprise with Ron Baker and Ed Klass. To find out more about our show, visit us on the web at thesoulofenterprise.com. You can also chat with us on Twitter using hashtag AskTSOE. Now, back to The Soul of Enterprise.
And we are back with Michael Bright, the chairman and CEO of Eisner Amper LLP. So it was music to my ears, Michael, when you talked about the huge technology budget exploding because, you know, we're working for the technology company. But and that is one of the emphasis that a lot of private equity involvement often is about driving innovation and growth, especially from the technology side. So what are your plans to leverage that? And especially with regard to innovation within, let's say, audit and attest, you know, part of the challenge with innovative accounting is that you can get thrown in jail for it, right? So got to be a little bit...
I'm glad you didn't say it was an oxymoron, Ed.
Right.
But yes. You know, when we look at really innovation and accounting, a lot of people have done audits the same way for years. But we are big, not only colleagues, licensors, and partners with the AICPA in developing a new audit methodology. And it's called the Dynamic Audit Solution, or DAS. So we're spending a lot of money. We're going to spend a lot of license money on that as well. And we're going to create a new audit methodology for our staff that's going to be more technology-based, that has AI components into it. And it's not going to be just a checklist mentality that all auditors have been used to for the last 40 or 50 years. It's really going to be much more insightful, and you're going to get ratios and changes and comparisons to other companies in regards to whether it be various financial ratios, etc. And I think it's going to make the accounting world, I truly believe, a little bit more exciting. So that's one of the areas that we're really putting a lot of money into. Again, the dynamic audit solution. We just went through an ERP system where we're implementing SAP. That obviously costs a lot of money. That's going to get us to, you know, a different level, you know, now that we approach $1 billion in revenues. So, you know, when we were bought out by Tower Brook, we were a $450 million firm. So as we grow, we know we need technology, you know, not only to further our goals and what we see on the horizon. So we do believe a new ERP system is going to help as well. And then, you know, you really look at all various audit tools that you have that you could, I've never seen when I go to our international association events, so many providers to the accounting industry in regard to accounts receivable tools, how you collect your receivables faster, better dashboards for your people. I must have saw 40 different technology providers there really servicing the professional services world. So it's just absolutely exploded.
Yeah, one of the things we had, Aaron Harris, who's the chief technology officer of Sage, on a couple of weeks ago. And then he also gave a great speech out at Sage Transform 2 weeks ago in Las Vegas. And, you know, one of the things that he said, because, you know, he's got this, his concept is continuous audit. So it sounds a lot like this dynamic audit, that the audit does not become one static event. It becomes a constant thing going on. And when he was then asked about it, where he said, well, what's this going to do to audit fees? They're $40 billion a year. He says it's going to double.
Well, that's an interesting prediction. I don't know about double it, but continuous auditing is something that's been around for a long time. And when, you know, you audit a public company and you have to go through a quarterly review, you know, if there's a transaction happening in that quarter, you want to audit it during that quarter. So that's what all public companies typically do. So when they talk about continuous auditing, if something happened in the second quarter, I'm not going to look at it, you know, 9 months later. I'm going to look at it during that quarterly review. So continuous auditing is kind of embedded in a lot of things we do. There are those many, many audits of companies that are only annual. And then you don't have the continuous auditing because sometimes you're not speaking to the CFO or the controller throughout the year. We encourage all of our people to constantly speak to our clients, find out what's going on, how we could help them. So we practice the policy of the principle of continuous auditing for all of our clients, or I'd like to think for almost all of our clients, Ed.
Well, one of the challenges, though, is that, you know, with the audit is about independence. And then, of course, you shift over and say, well, now we're starting to get involved in maybe at least providing the numbers for a strategy. That's always been a no-no. So there really has to be something that resolves around here. Don't you think that we've got to get some resolution around this?
So that's an age-old question, Ed. It's been something that's been said for many, many. So if you're an accountant and you get paid $10,000 for an audit and you have to deliver an audit opinion, just the mere taking of the $10,000 from that client CFO where you're delivering an audit opinion, there are then naysayers out there. Well, that creates an independence problem right there. And there should be a separate, whether it be a subsidiary, a consortium, where the money goes somewhere else and gets redistributed. Well, we don't think that that's practical. We don't think that's operational. It's not expedient. So at its very essence, you know, some people would say you have an independence issue. But, you know, again, if you do not have a financial interest in the company, if none of the partners can own one share of stock in that company, that's the way we protect it. And that's our sacrosanct, that we have to be independent in fact, that we, again, don't have a financial interest in the company, and independent in appearance, that I don't go on vacation with any CFO and pay for that vacation for him or her or for the family just because they're a client. So we really, I mean, those are the strict guidelines that we live by every day. Independent in fact, independent in appearance. Will they change over time? Trust me, the PCAOB talks about a lot. They review independence guidelines, and I think we're in a pretty good place. But could they change? They might change in future years.
One of the things that I'm seeing, and I work with our SIAP program, the Sage Intacct Accountants Program, and one of the things that we are seeing a lot of happening is, especially in the not-for-profit sector, is which they of course have to be audited, is firms giving up the audit to do the CAS work instead. So I think that that's a very interesting trend. Do you care to comment on that?
I would. So CAS is growing in our outsourcing group in leaps and bounds. It's like nothing I've ever seen before, double-digit growth, because the one thing about CAS, first of all, it's much less riskier than an audit. And once you're involved in doing the books and records and updating them, it creates a very, very sticky relationship. And it's very unusual or rare where a client will leave that relationship after a year or even 2 years. So you have a much longer window and time to ride that client relationship with CAS. It's less risky. It's profitable. So it checks off all those buckets. So a lot of times we have to make a decision because we have a very, very large private equity fund administration business. So do we want to do the real estate audit or do we want to do the real estate private equity books and records? And we have to make then a decision because clearly you can't do both. So we have that kind of conundrum or that good decision to make very, very often.
Yeah, especially it affects not-for-profits because they have to change every so often, right? They have to change who the auditor is. And
it depends on their charter. There's no governmental ruling on it, but some nonprofits have a charter where they said, yes, you have to change your auditors every 10 years or so. Correct.
So a question I have for you, and this goes back to, I don't know if you remember David Maister. He wrote a lot of books on professional service organizations a long, long time ago. And one of the things that he talks about is with regard to mergers and acquisitions, and I would qualify the private equity move as along those lines, is he said the only real benefit, you should judge it on what are the benefits to your current customers, to your current clients. So talk to me a little bit about what are the benefits to your current, the ones that you have right now, your clients.
So they're great benefits. And I think all of the firms that have gone through PE will tell you the great benefits. The benefits are greater resources. We're going to attract people. We're going to attract better people. And we're going to have an easier time recruiting, which then we could then staff on your engagement. So there's so many benefits really on the resources side, on the technology side. We'll deliver to you a much more efficient audit. Our tax services will have more technology embedded in them because we have now a private equity arm. So between the resources, the advances in technology, it's going to make for a better experience. And because we're growing, we're going to grow our service base. So instead of having 100 services that we provide, we'll now have 200 services that we provide that we could offer you everything from, whether it be a cost segregation analysis to property accounting review to an ESG review. So now we do all of that. So the breadth and depth of our services increase. So when you add all of that together, technology, resources, breadth and depth of our services, our clients love it because they see us as obviously a bigger, more powerful firm that's going to add, obviously, and help them and help them grow their successes.
I'm going to ask you to take your Eisner Amper hat off for a second and just look at the profession as a whole. You said that you guys are hitting your target numbers for recruitment, which is I think is great. But there's clearly still a dearth of new talent entering into public accounting right now, just in terms of even number of people graduating with a degree. Again, aside from Eisner Amper, can you just say what do you think should the profession at large needs to do to change that ship around?
So again, we've been talking about the 150-hour credit rule for a long, long time. It's been in place for really over 30 years. And I know the AICPA is trying to make some changes and adjustments and internships and co-op programs where you don't have to have that full 150. You could work for another firm after graduating for 4 years. That is to me an issue because, you know, in the area where you have underprivileged and students that might not have, you know, the wherewithal for a fifth year of college, they might say, well, why do I need to go into accounting? So we're combating that. We're trying to address that every day. The other thing I think we need to do, Ed, very, very honestly, is raise the starting salaries. We have seen the STEM graduates all of a sudden surpass accounting to some degree. And we're saying, wait a minute, you know, why should a marketing major or a finance major make more than someone in public accounting? So we really have to look into it and say, what are we doing? Do we have to make a major shift in regard to change in the starting salaries? And obviously, as you know, that would have a ripple effect, you know, in regard to the seniors and managers, et cetera. So it's something I think all the firms are talking about because we want to still see the same amount and level of graduates come into the profession. Because you're right, we are losing graduates. The best thing to do right now is address their concerns. And one of them is on a compensation level.
And maybe even allow for career change. What about that into the accounting profession for those that didn't graduate with an accounting degree?
So that comes up all the time. A lot of people said, you know, I started my career in finance, economics, et cetera, and I want to go into accounting. There are so many different avenues to go. We hire a lot of experienced seniors and managers into our firm all the time. And, you know, we give them some time. Sometimes they're not even certified, and we give them time to get certified as well. But I do believe that's going to increase over time. You know, as that pool gets tighter and tighter and tighter, you're going to go after liberal arts majors and other non-accounting majors to come into the firm because you need the resources.
Well, Michael, this is great. Unfortunately, we're up against our next break. I want to remind those of you out there that if you want to contact Ron or me, you can send one email to asktsoe@verisage.com. Of course, the website is The Soul of Enterprise, where you can see show notes as well as previews to upcoming shows. Ron mentioned earlier that we do have a Patreon channel now, patreon.com/TSOE. There you can listen to our shows commercial free, as well as our bonus episodes, which we do after each week's show. But right now, a word from our sponsors.
Enjoying our shows and can't get enough of us? Follow us on Instagram at Voice America Talk Radio and see what we're cooking up for you.
Sage provides accountants with compliance, reporting, and analytic solutions to do more for their clients. These solutions include education programs such as the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Service Program. This program delivers the tools to create, package, price, market, and deliver additional services to clients, increasing your profitability and delivering more value to your clients. Let Sage help you grow your business by visiting sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
Have you ever listened to an online radio show that changed your life? I'm required to say that I have. Have you ever stopped listening to an online radio show because the commercials were mind-numbingly repetitive? Of course you haven't, because you're here right now. Look, you don't have to listen to me anymore. There's a commercial-free version of this show, and it only costs $10 a month. And for $15 a month, you get no commercials plus bonus content. Go to patreon.com/TSOE, subscribe now, and be free. You're worth it.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned into The Soul of Enterprise with Ron Baker and Ed Klass. To find out more about our show, visit us on the web at thesoulofenterprise.com. You can also chat with us on Twitter using #AskTSOE. Now, back to The Soul of Enterprise.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here with Michael Bright, the chairman and CEO of Eisner Amper. And Michael, you talked about some of this with Ed, but I just want to ask you this. You know, the Boy Scouts have this famous dictum that we leave the camp better than we found it. And I've just been thinking about private equity. How is it going to leave the accounting profession better than it found it when these guys do exit? You talked a little bit about how the customers benefit, how the team members benefit. Can you expand on that? How else do the team members benefit from, rather than just say an increase in pay?
So I think, you know, we still manage the firm. And Ron, when I look at Eisner Amper, I look at it for so many great things, for innovation, for our people, how we have a profitable enterprise, that how we're firmly planted in the mid-market. And I made this analogy many, many times, that we're always going to be Eisner Amper. So we could go through a monetization event, another private equity firm could take it over. But I look at my hometown heroes, the New York Mets, you know, whether they're owned by Nelson Doubleday or Fred Wilpon or Steve Cohen, they're still going to be the New York Mets, Ron. And I think Eisner Amper, we have such an incredible culture. We treat people the way they want to be treated. And to me, that's going to have tremendous endurance. It's going to live on for a long time. And as CEO, I think about that every day. How do I make this a better place for my partners and really for the staff that I see every day? What can I do to make sure that they're thriving in years to come like I have done? I'm in my 40th year in public accounting. I still have a lot of energy, a lot of vigor, because I think it's an incredible, incredible profession.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned the Mets, so now I know what the fourth and last segment's going to be all about with Ed. But Michael, talk me specifically off the ledge, because I've heard this now from two different people on two different podcasts talking about how private equity has come into accounting firms and, you know, voicing opinions on how it should be run and governance and things like that. And what both of these people said, and two people I respect very greatly, they said there's been a lot of pressure from private equity on the firms to increase billings and realization rates. Now, you know, Ed and I are anti-hourly billing, but is this true? Because if it is, that worries me.
So I don't know, again, increased billing, increased realization rates, you know, private equity wants you to perform at your highest level. So if you have a budget and you say, I'm going to grow 2%, like any other private equity firm, they go, you know what, if you really put the bar at a very low level, it's going to be easy for you to jump over it. So private equity does raise the bar, no question about it. They're looking, you know, when Carol Brook came to us, they said, we consider you one of the best mid-market firms in the country, and we expect great results. So, you know, again, I'll make the analogy, if you think you're going to grow 2%, private equity would be happy, they won't be. So they continually raise the bar, but they're there with you to direct you. How can we help? What can we do? What other people do you need? How can we help with integration? Is there anyone else you need to hire? We have those conversations all the time, but make no mistake about it. You know, they want results, and they want to obviously, you know, make a return on their investment.
I would have thought, though, being sophisticated business people, that they would see some of the downsides of hourly billing and maybe prod the firms into more of a value pricing. I know you guys have a pricing initiative at Eisner. Has that ever come up?
I don't know if it's come up all that often. You know, we're driving a very, very, as you know, Ron, big value pricing initiative. We're calling it the collaborative engagement model. And it's had, so far has great, great successes to it. As it relates to private equity, you know, they see the value in value billing. And I think they're behind us 1,000%. If they think, if we're saying this is where we're going to go and we believe it's additive and we believe the clients are going to react better to it, they're behind us 1,000%. Did they bring it on themselves? They did not, simply because they want us to manage the business and they'll direct us when they see either a sharp left-hand turn or surprise, something like that.
How do you see AI being used in the firm right now? I mean, we hear a lot of different stories about how people are using it. It's slowly being integrated. How are you using it?
Well, we are using it. Our CIO has a huge AI and generative AI initiatives going out right now for a lot of the mundane tasks that we do on the audit side. So we're slowly rolling it out right now. I think I mentioned earlier that DAS has an AI component as well. So the dynamic audit solution has an AI component, but we're being very careful. We're putting our toe in the water because, again, concerned about obviously, where it goes. Is that information all accurate? How much can it be relied upon? So we're doing it very, very slowly, I would say.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Michael, I'm just curious. I know BDO is adopted in ESOP. And was that ever considered? And what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of an ESOP as opposed to what you did?
So we did not consider an ESOP. When we heard about it, we thought that was a very interesting strategy. Besides BDO, Grassi also now instituted an ESOP. And we think there are advantages to it, but depending on, again, what you want to accomplish. I think BDO used it for a lot of reasons. One, to refinance their debt. Another one, as it relates to some payoff of some supplemental retirement of retiring partners. But then they also made the case that this is going to be great for everyone because through this ESOP, you earn what I like to call pension credits. And if you're there for a number of years, you're going to earn those credits. And that seems to be very favored by a lot of people, both on the professional side, on the administration side. So BDO felt that that was the way to go. They spoke and talked about private equity, but they thought a lot of the advantages of the ESOP and tax advantages as well. So again, it was not for us, but BDO made it work. And I think it's moving along well for them.
Yeah. I heard the chairman talk about it and, you know, being able to offer new talent, those pension credits, as you say, might help them attract talent. It's not every day, Michael, that we get an auditor on this show. We've talked to Chris Vanover from Audit Club. And I was just wondering, you know, we hear about peekaboo deficiencies, the fines they've leveled out for these SPAC audits, audit failures, not just here in the States, but around the world. I thought Sarbanes-Oxley was going to fix all this. What do you think the state of the profession is today? And I'm specifically talking about auditing and a test.
So again, the PCAOB has been, you know, coming down on accounting firms if, again, they feel they're deficient. I saw fines, independence infractions, et cetera. Sarbanes is already, Ron, 22 years old. So I still think that, look, most of the only issue we have is that, you know, when you have one deficiency in an audit, for instance, let's say there's some critical audit matters and it's supposed to be technically documented in a single piece of paper in a file. And let's say it's not, but it's documented in other places. Well, that's a deficiency. So I've always said you could have done 99 things right. But if you don't have that critical audit matters documentation where it should be, well, then you have a deficient audit. So I would love for people to say that you do, that you've done a good audit, but you just don't hear that nowadays because they focus on the deficiencies. The PCAOB is there as the regulator, you know, for all the public company, all those accounting firms that handle public company work, and they want to make sure that work is done with a standard of excellence. So again, they raise the bar, in my view. Over the last few years, the reviews have been much tougher, and they look at everything. So again, you know, where you might have done, like I said, 99 things well, did one thing wrong, it's still classified as a deficiency. And that's what people see from the reports. So all of a sudden they see big firms, smaller firms with all these deficiencies and say like you, what's going on? What's going on with the profession? It's again, the PCAOB has a very, very, very high standard in my view.
Yeah. What things would you change about the auditing profession if you were king for a day or could wave a magic wand?
I would say that, you know, we should try to work with the clients and come up with solutions together. Again, knowing we have some independence issues, but you know, what I've seen with a lot of clients is they don't have the accounting help now. Because again, if we don't have people going into public accounting, you could imagine what's going on the private side that they don't have that help. So I would like to see the accountants work with the CFO and controllers and help them and get them to a better place versus waiting and waiting. Oh, we don't have this. We don't have that. Well, we're your accountants. We can't put this together or help you out. I'd like to see more of a collegial, collaborative effort because I think it'll be better for the companies and I think it'll be better for the audits. So that's what I would do if I had a magic wand, though I don't know how far I could go with independence concerns.
Right. What about auditor rotation? Has that made a difference?
So I don't believe the auditor rotation is in, places like the UK. With respect to public company reporting, you know, you have to rotate your auditor, really rotate the engagement partner every 5 years. Now, that was changed from 7 years. Do I think that helps a little bit? It does. There are certain other big firms for even private companies where they rotate the auditor every 10 years. I'm not a big fan of rotating the auditor itself. I'm talking about the engagement partner. Yes. I don't know if it helps all that much. As Ed talked about earlier, there are certain nonprofits that have it in their charter that they need the auditors to rotate. That means firing an accounting firm that has all this institutional knowledge and then setting up another accounting firm. I truly don't believe that's in the best interest of the company because, you know, what are you saying? You believe that the auditor's ripping you off? You believe that the auditor's taking money from you? It has a lot of other innuendos, which I feel are unwarranted and not just.
Got it. All right, Michael, one last question maybe. You're talking to a young high school student or maybe a young college student, and they're thinking about studying to be a CPA. What do you tell them?
I said, there's no better profession. You learn something new every day. You never stagnate. You work on a technical matter. You work with a client. You work with mentoring. You work with developing other people. You'll do recruiting. You'll bring in business and you're going to love it. And when you put that all together, we do a lot of different things in accounting. It's not just coming to the office every day and checking off numbers. Why I love the profession is that I have a different day every day, Ron. Every day for me is different. And that's what I love about it because I look at different things. I have high technical challenges. I deal with complex issues that I really enjoy dealing with. So for everything about public accounting, the flexibility as well, because we don't now make you come into work every day. It's 3 or 4 days a week, which most of the accounting firms are now behind and encouraging. So between the flexibility, the amount of advancement that you'll have, and we make a pretty good living, I think it's an outstanding, outstanding way to go.
Yeah, I find, Michael, when I talk to high school students that they have so many stereotypes. And when you tell them what you just said, like most accountants spend their day interacting with people and helping them solve problems and pursue opportunities, they're astonished that we're just not in the back room crunching numbers. Well, Michael, this has been so great. Thank you so much for coming on and shedding some light on Eisner's private equity structure. And Ed's going to take you the rest of the way home. And folks, if you want to get a hold of me or Ed, you can send us an email to asktsoe@verisage.com. And now a word from our sponsor and Ed's employer, Sage.
A little birdie told me Voice America is on X. Follow us at Voice America TRN.
Sage provides accountants with compliance, reporting, and analytic solutions to do more for their clients. These solutions include education programs such as the Sage Accountants Network Client Advisory Service Program. This program delivers the tools to create, package, price, market, and deliver additional services to clients, increasing your profitability and delivering more value to your clients. Let Sage help you grow your business by visiting sageaccountantsnetwork.com.
Have you ever been so annoyed by a commercial for a $5 ebook that you were willing to pay $10 to never hear it again? I sure have. Hello, I'm Greg Kite. Over the last several years, you've come to hate me, and I hate me too. By now, you know that for $5, you can get a copy of Ron and Ed's book. What you might not know is, for twice that much every month for forever, you can stop hearing me plug Ron and Ed's book, which totally makes sense, like the Diamond Water Paradox. Go to patreon.com/TSOE and subscribe today. Please, for the love of God, make it stop!
the Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are tuned into The Soul of Enterprise with Ron Baker and Ed Klass. To find out more about our show, visit us on the web at thesoulofenterprise.com. You can also chat with us on Twitter using hashtag AskTSOE. Now, back to The Soul of Enterprise.
And we are back on The Soul of Enterprise with Michael Bright. And Michael, we're gonna shift topics here. We're going to leave that accounting behind for now. It still might be business involved in some way, but we're going to leave the private equity and all that stuff behind. You wrote a blog post back on your blog back in 2018. It's called "The Business of Sports Embraces the Future." You made some predictions there, and I'm not going to hold you to them, but I just want to ask you about some of the topics to see what you think and how they've evolved since 2018. The first one that you list is esports. Back in 2018, I went with my son to an esports competition right here in Allen, Texas, where they filled a small arena, fit 5,000 people screaming, you know, 13 and 14 year olds. It's kind of fizzled out. Was COVID the challenge there? What's happening?
No question about it. Everyone thought esports would be the next biggest thing. And they saw these competitions in arenas where people would play against each other video games. And it was astounding to me as a sports guy. But then COVID hit. We knew a bunch of other companies that got set up in esports to do this. And they floundered because obviously everyone was set in. Now, can you say esports may include betting? In that regard, and FanDuel and DraftKings. So in that regard, some esports has done very, very well, because at the end of the day, you could say esports is in the arena, on the arena. And as it relates to the physical side, it has fizzled out. But as it relates to betting, that has gone bonkers. That has just absolutely gone through the roof in regard to many, many big companies involved. You know, a lot of people want to watch them. If Tiger Woods was playing, they want to immediately bet that Tiger on a par three would hit the green or not. And that will eventually come very, very soon. So there are going to be a whole millions and millions of people into that. Again, is that a derivation of esports? It is. So that, yeah, I think is going to continue.
Gambling was also on your list as well, sports gambling. And it really has morphed and changed a little bit. Is that overall, do you think that's positive from a fan perspective? Does it create more involvement in some way, do you think?
It does. It creates a lot more involvement. Look, there were people always, you know, they did whatever bets they might have done in their neighborhood, in their community. And now as it relates to getting a little bit more regulated, I think is the way to go. You know, there were a lot of, I think Adam Silver was one of the first commissioners in an op-ed to say, we need to get gambling. We need to get it regulated. And he spoke out about it for the profession. And now you see, T, you would never think in years that there'd be a hockey team in Las Vegas. That would never happen. A football team in Las Vegas, and now you have them. So all of a sudden, people's views have changed. People's, as they relate to gambling, if they think it's regulated, they think it's a good way to go, because yes, it does attract more people to the sport.
As long as it's not taken to an extreme, but it's like anything else, right? You know, with the alcohol, et cetera, prohibition, as long as people can regulate it. I guess the danger is that, you know, these apps are they're gamified in and of themselves, right? You know, you don't have there's no app that's saying reminding you to take that drink all the time, but there's one saying, hey, listen, you haven't placed your bets today. Right.
There is. And you know what? There's, you know, everyone's an adult and we like to have everyone under control and bet responsibly. And I do hope that it doesn't come to a bigger issue down the road, that we see a lot of obviously casualties because of this. I can't predict that. I hope it doesn't happen.
Well, the next two topics would also potentially conflate those that you talked about. One is streaming and how streaming is done. But then the other thing is virtual reality, because those are clearly related. I can tell you this right now with the advent of Apple Vision Pro. If the MLB would sell me a seat behind home plate at Citi Field, take my money. Like, take it right now.
It's very interesting you said that, because I think a general manager, and I want to say it was a Mets general manager years ago, made a prediction that in the future, stadiums will only fill around 10,000 people because everyone is going to want to watch the game on their VR headset and watch the balls and watch the foul balls come into them, et cetera, because they think it's going to be just an incredible viewing experience. Do I think that's going to happen? I think not, because there's a certain feeling of community out in the arena, whether it be a 40,000 or 50,000 seat stadium. But I have also, Ed, I've seen some VR results and I am just blown away by the quality. And we know it's only going to improve. We know the headsets are only going to get smaller. We know they're going to get a lot easier to use. You could now buy a MetaQuest for under $250. That never happened. Years ago, you never ever thought that would happen. I remember there was a movie Disclosure that was 1997 talking about virtual reality. So again, it's taken a while. Like AI, I think it's getting here, and I think it's here to stay, and it's only going to improve. On the streaming side, well, you see this all the time. You see it in the NFL of what's going on. For the first time, a playoff game is going through NBC's Peacock streaming services. Never for a major broadcast network in NBC Peacock to have streamed a game in a championship format. But obviously we have Amazon and others that are now streaming games, and that clearly will be the wave of the future.
What do you think about one of the things that Ron and I think is amiss is the inability to subscribe to your team? Like, we can subscribe to MLB, but if I could subscribe to the Mets, let's say, and get all of these other ancillary benefits, I think that would be better off. Is that something because Major League Baseball is trying to consolidate it? Or do you think it would be better if let the flowers bloom with all of the different teams, with 32 teams? Let it bloom. Right. See what they come up with.
There are a lot of reasons for it, and a lot of people are naysayers against it. You know, they always want to have a national program. So, you know, again, there are certain sponsors that have national rights, certain sponsors have local rights, and sometimes they interfere. So that's part of the issue right there. But you're totally right. For the benefit of the consumer, you're a transplanted New Yorker living in Texas, living in California. You want to see whether it be the Mets, the Yankees, the Jets, etc. So I think that's a positive thing. Do I think we'll get there? I think the answer is yes, but they have to work out, again, national rights versus local rights and how they do that.
Is it just a question of a lot of the existing contracts expanding themselves out, and then we're going to update that in the future once those things end?
That's a big part of it, correct, because they all have different expiration dates. That's exactly right. And some national rights, there's some rights all of a sudden, you know, that you have certain preemptive rights against. And so it's a lot to work out in regard to when you look at all the media rights that baseball attaches. They want to make sure that they're controlling it at the national level, and sometimes it gets complicated.
Do you think that there's anything being a foundation being laid for setting up these 360 degree cameras in different spots in arenas or, you know, in different stadia, especially for things like the Super Bowl or like World Series, so that even if people are not able to do it today, they might be available in the future? Imagine, you know, being able, Michael, to go watch the 1969 World Series again, you know, from in a 360 degree headset environment. How cool would that be?
I think that, you know, look, they colorize films. They do a lot of things. I think that would be awesome. And I think a lot of people would love to do that. You know, you look at, you know, obviously the technological advances in sports. You know, you probably remember the first and 10 yellow line that was invented 30 years ago by Sport Vision. Then they had the glowing puck. And then they had the batter's box in baseball. So I think something like that, though, to actually see, you know, Ed Cranepool and Gary Gentry. And I know, Ed, I'm bringing back a lot of names from the past here. And Tommy Agee, I think people would love to see that, honestly. And I hope it could get done. I really, really do.
Yeah, in kind of some kind of virtual reality type thing. Okay, so what is the most evil thing in sports, and why is it the designated hitter?
Well, you know, that's been talked about for a long time, you know, how two leagues could look at things a little bit differently. But again, you know, the American League feels it was the way to go, get more hitting, more offensive production power in. The National League, you know, was a little bit more traditional. So again, is that the most evil thing in sports? I don't think it's the most evil thing in sports. No. But again, as it relates to the DH, I'm sure it will continue on now for years.
Yeah, killed strategy, and now it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous in both leagues. I can't take it. I don't even like the instant replay either. You know what? Let's let umpires make mistakes and fire those that are suck. I'm talking to you, Angel Hernandez. Okay, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Michael, for appearing on the Soul of Enterprise. Ron, what do we got coming up next week?
Next week, Ed, we're going to talk to Scott Reeb about subscription-based legal services.
All right. I can't wait. I'll see you in 167 hours.
This has been the Soul of Enterprise, Business and the Knowledge Economy, sponsored by Sage, transforming the way people think and work, enabling their organizations to thrive. Join us next week, folks, on Friday at noon Pacific time. In the meantime, check us out at thesoulofenterprise.com. Also, you can contact Ed or me at asktsoe@verisage.com. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a great weekend.